I call the Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:05 PM on Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024. We're meeting today in Davis Room 106 of the Capitol Building. Please silence your cell phones out of courtesy to others attending. Committee members in attendance today, we have Representative McCormick, Representative Ruffridge, Representative Sadler, Representative Mina, and myself, Chair Prox. So we have a quorum to do business. And I want to introduce my committee aide, Riley Nye. Please pass any correspondence with the committee members through Mr. Nye. And we are just indebted to our House Records Recorder, Cheryl Cole, and Zach Lawhorn, our teleconference moderator. On our agenda today, we have confirmation of governor's appointees, John Lloyd to the Board of Chiropractic Examiners, Ashley Shaber to the Board of Pharmacy, Bradley McConnell and Lauren Bradbury to the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners. And we will also hear public testimony, of course, on these appointments. And then our other item is the initial hearing of HB 91, Major Medical Emergencies, sponsored by Representative Mina. And we'll be taking invited testimony on that bill. And I would note that Representative Fields joined us. Right, so our first item is confirmation hearing for Mr. Lloyd. His appointment to the Board of Chiropractic Examiners. Mr. Lloyd, would you please introduce yourself, put your name on the record, and please let us know about why you want to be on the Board of Chiropractic Examiners.
Hello, this is Dr. John Lloyd, and so a colleague had asked me to do this a couple of years ago. I did the chiropractic board as kind of a courtesy to him, and actually thoroughly enjoyed it. So I did. I just completed the assignment for the chiropractic board, and am up for renewal, and have been graciously approved at this point to have an opportunity to do it again, and been a chiropractor for 26 years here in and then my practice in Anchorage, Alaska, and happy to serve on the board, and again was a wonderful experience, and doing it here one more round is kind of the objective today.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions from the committee for Mr. Lloyd?
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Mr. Chair, you never want to let an appointee get away scot-free here, so I will ask a question too. Dr. Wells, yeah, you put yourself up to it, sir. Do chiropractic practitioners in Alaska practice to the full scope of their practice? That's been a theme we've often heard from different medical practitioners in Alaska, that they're trained, equipped, able, and willing to do so much more. Is that the case with the practice of chiropractic in Alaska?
The practice of chiropractic in Alaska, we do have a wide scope, and so the majority of techniques that we can do are approved through the board. There are a few areas that we learn in chiropractic school that we are not able to participate here in Alaska. One of those would be the acupuncture techniques. Those are quite often available for trained chiropractors, but not in Alaska. Animal chiropractic adjusting for adjustments on animals is also one that is not provided here in Alaska. Other than that, the scope pretty well encompasses what is learned in chiropractic school. So I'd say, overall, it's an excellent scope of practice.
Representative Sadler.
And I will throw you a kind of a wide pitch here. What issues do you think that your continued service on the board will bring you in contact with? What issues do you think are going to be facing the board the next couple of years during your next appointment, if you should have them?
Well, I think the biggest thing that we're running into as chiropractors is long COVID and a lot of people that are coming in with health complaints that they didn't have previously. And so I think what the board is going to be up to, up against is what are the techniques that are researched and scientifically valid to help people with that? And of course, nutrition is part of that, which is what a chiropractor helps with. But I think the other part people are starting to see is that different types of infusions and ozone therapy and different styles of care are also being effective. And will that be something that a chiropractor is trained to do or not? And I think I can see that being something that will develop down the road for the chiropractic profession. As with probably all health professions, insurance does get tighter every year. The cost of employees and the cost of business goes up, and the reimbursements from insurance does go down. And so that's always something that is on our mind. It does seem like the higher reimbursement the providers have, the less trouble we have as a board as far as making sure that everybody is appropriately working with inside their license. I can see as insurance downturns, what we're predicting in the next year or so, there might be more activity with the board just in making sure that everybody is focusing within their scope of practice.
Okay, thank you.
Those would be the two I would see.
Representative Field.
Thank you, through the chair. I appreciate learning more about what you're saying with long COVID, and I'm kind of curious how are providers sharing best practices, not just chiropractors, but doctors in Alaska about treatment techniques that work. From what I've heard anecdotally, declining federal research funding is a concern because there's a bunch of people out there with long COVID. I'm curious how you're following best practices and helping your patients be aware of whatever treatments might be out there.
The likely way that the information is getting out to providers is through the 3 and 4 day weekend seminars. And so there's a number of seminars that have treatment strategies and some of the research that's done in a continuing education basis. And then there are also certifications that can be done for different functional medicine backgrounds to help with ailments. That happens a lot. The other part that happens quite often is it's a very close group of colleagues. And when one provider starts to see results, they do often help to share that with other providers that are trying to find results that help with people. And that's done through a lot of different platforms. One of the platforms would be through different private Facebook messaging groups, or through seminars, or through learning from some of the professors that are really looking into this at the colleges as well.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Lloyd? So now I will open public testimony on the appointment of John Lloyd to the Board of Chiropractic Examiners. Do we have anyone in the room that wants to testify on Mr. Lloyd's appointment? Seeing none, do we have anyone online that wants to testify on Mr. Lloyd's appointment to the Board of Chiropractic Examiners? And hearing none, public testimony is now closed. And I guess if anyone wants to send testimony, they can email their comments to us at hhss@akleg.gov. So thank you, Mr. Lloyd, and we'll sign the paperwork for his confirmation hearing at the end of this process.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Have a great one.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Next, we have the confirmation of Ashley Shaver to the Board of Pharmacy. Ms. Shaver, would you please come up to the witness table, put your name on record, and explain your desire to be on the Board of Pharmacy?
Yes. For the record, my name is Ashley Shaver. Good afternoon, Chair Prox, members of the committee. My name is Ashley Schaber. I'm excited to be here today. This is for a reappointment. My service on the board started in July of 2021, and I have served actively since then. I've served as chair since December 2022. I've been licensed as a pharmacist in Alaska for over 16 years. Prior to moving to Alaska, I lived and went to school in Georgia. My background here includes community pharmacy, postgraduate residency and leadership training, and work within Alaska's tribal health system. I've practiced in a variety of areas, including inpatient pharmacy, medication safety, quality improvement management, and leadership at the Alaska Native Medical Center since 2007. Also had several active leadership roles within the Alaska Pharmacist Association. So I'm really looking forward to continuing using my background and my experience on the board. Personally, my family and I live in East Anchorage. We're active community members. My boys play sports, so I stay really busy with hockey and baseball and hiking, fishing, and keeping them busy. During my time on the board, we've seen a lot of progress towards our strategic goal and ultimately improving safety and access for pharmacy in Alaska. Wanted to thank members of this committee specifically and the legislator for the passing of House Bill 112 last year. That was important for the board to increase safety and access to pharmacy services in Alaska. We've also had multiple regulatory packages that have come before that bill and then as a result of that bill that have helped improve efficiency with our Board of Pharmacy and the Division for Licensing. Currently, we are focusing on House Bill 226, which improves access to safe pharmacy services in Alaska. Many of the issues that are part of House Bill 226 are issues that have limited access to pharmacy services in Alaska. And this practices have limited care to our patients and the unique aspects of the geography and access of Alaska in general have limited pharmacy services. So I wanted to let you know that that is a current focus of our board. Also during my time as chair, we've been focusing on efficiency of the board. So we have gone from 2-day meetings to 1-day meetings. This is important for our board members who are also volunteer and work as pharmacists in the community. Also important for our division because it's more efficient for the division. We also, during our time, have advocated to have online license applications, and that significantly helped decrease the turnaround time for licensing pharmacy technicians and pharmacists in the state. We've also been using subcommittees to get work done in between our quarterly meetings, and that's been really successful as well. So overall, I'm looking for ways to continue to use my background in leadership to improve public health, safety, and welfare for all of Alaskans. I believe I will continue to be an asset to and work well with the current board, the division staff, as well as the legislator, if confirmed to a second term. So thank you for your time today.
Okay, thank you. Do we have questions for Ms. Schaber, Representative Fields?
Thank you, through the chair. Thanks, Ms. Schaber, for your awesome work on the board. I was just curious. I know you've worked on workforce development, and I was curious if through that work on the board and at ANMC, if you have thoughts about things that the state could do better to support aspiring pharmacists and pharmacy training. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for the question through the chair to Representative Fields. In terms of supporting workforce development, one of the unique areas that the board has been able to support has been the apprenticeship programs that our state offers. The board did pass a regulation that allows pharmacy technicians to become licensed as young as 16 if they are in an apprenticeship program that's approved by the board. And so we recognize that there was a gap. There are sometimes high school juniors, high school seniors that are interested in going into the profession, and the way our regulations previously read prohibited that. So that is something that we changed as a board. And then in terms of my work at the Alaska Native Medical Center, we've had an apprenticeship program for a couple of years, and we've seen several pharmacy technicians go through successfully in that program and stay on board as pharmacy technicians at our organization. So it has been successful for workforce development. We also have a School of Pharmacy here in the state through the Idaho State University of Alaska partnership. So we have student rotations and work closely with the school to help encourage people to go into pharmacy.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair, Dr. Shaver. We've heard from you on a number of occasions on different bills. I appreciate you being here. I appreciate you joining us to serve again. I'd like to invite you to comment, if you could, on the ecosystem for the practice of pharmacy in Alaska. Is it healthy? Are there areas that need reform? Is there a proper mixture of chain pharmacists versus independents? Just like to hear your general thoughts on the state of the practice in Alaska.
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, I would use one word to describe it. I would call it fragile right now. We have very limited pharmacy infrastructure in providing care to our patients, especially in more of our niche pharmacy areas like compounding, both sterile compounding, non-sterile compounding, infusion, and then what we would consider compliance packaging, which is a bubble pack. You all may have seen bubble packs for patients who are in assisted living facilities or who have complex medication needs. It's a way to include or encourage compliance with medication adherence. That type of packaging has decreased hospitalizations, decreased ER visits. And so we're seeing less and less of those niche areas in pharmacy, and that's contributed to a fragile ecosystem. And I would say that in general, the reason behind that, and we're seeing that across the board for independent pharmacies, chain pharmacies, pharmacies within the tribal health system, it's our reimbursement, what we're seeing with reimbursements. And so part of that is addressed in House Bill 226.
Okay. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Dr. Shaver, thanks for being here today. As always, as a pharmacist in the state, appreciate the work that you've done on the board, and I enjoy working together with you and other members of the board on a lot of different projects. But I wanted to see if you could speak to a couple of things that I know I personally have thought has gone really well in your time at the board. Two things. One, the responsibility that the board has for its, paying its own bills, and the cost that it takes to do that, and how you've been able to manage those costs and balance the budget while reducing license fees. I hope you could speak to that, because that's something that doesn't happen often in my experience here thus far. And the second is sort of restoring back the idea that a board should have some regulatory oversight in regards to investigations and on-site visits, and I think that was something that you put a lot of effort into in your time as board chair, restoring that. So if you could just give that a brief introduction to committee members, I think that would be really helpful.
Yes, thank you for the question. Through the chair to Representative Ruffridge. So for part one, regarding the balance between license fees and expenses for the board, our board does do an excellent job through license fees for managing the costs associated with the board. One example is decreasing our meeting time so that we're using less division hours and division time related to that. We typically do end with a surplus. That has been very common in the last couple of years to end with a surplus. We do have a great division team that works on that budget. But part of that is setting the license fees, recognizing that we have different types of licenses and evaluating those license fees. We want to keep them as low as possible while also sustaining the function of the board and the division. And then for the second part of the question, in terms of restoring back the regulatory oversight for on-site visits, we do have an investigations team, and it is important for our state-specific investigators to routinely inspect our pharmacies in the state. We have a regular process. We actually have an investigator dedicated just to the Board of Pharmacy, and she does a great job doing inspections on a regular basis and providing feedback to the licensees in the state, providing feedback to the board if there is an issue that's identified. And we do, as a board, work very closely with our investigations team for anything that is found during an investigation or that comes forward as a complaint. Through the chair, did that answer your question, Representative Ruffridge?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, any other Questions for Ms. Shaver? Very good. So at this point, I will open public testimony for the appointment of Ashley Shaver to the Board of Pharmacy. Do we have anyone in the room that would like to testify on her appointment? And do we have anyone online that would like to testify to the appointment of Ashley Shaver to the Board of Pharmacy? Good. Oh, we do. We do.
Hello,
have,
can you hear me?
Brandy, Ms. Sigur-Martin?
Yes. Hello, Chair Prox and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Brandy Sigur-Martin. I'm the executive director for the Alaska Pharmacy Association. Dr. Shaver already discussed some of her excellent work in her previous and current roles, and I'm here just to share with the committee our unwavering support for the legislature to confirm her continued service to the Alaska Board of Pharmacy. Dr. Shaver has done an exceptional work in leading the board as a chair, and she is highly regarded across the state and also throughout the pharmacy profession. And I would be happy to take any questions.
Okay, do we have any questions for Ms. Sigur-Martin? All right. Thank you for your testimony. Do we have anyone else online that wants to testify to the appointment of Ashley Shaver to the Board of Pharmacy? Hearing none, if anyone does want to send in comments, they can email them to hhss@akleg.gov, and that is the committee's email address. And do we have any other questions? Thank you again for your service and look forward to working with you some more.
Thank you for having me today.
Okay, next we have the confirmation of Bradley McConnell to the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners. Mr. McConnell, if you would please put yourself on record and explain your qualifications for the Board of Pharmacologists and Pharmacological Associate Examiners, and say that fast three times.
Yes. this is Bradley McConnell. I am seeking reappointment for the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners. Since I was elected, I was confirmed back in, I believe, February of 2020, right as COVID was occurring. And as a board, with my colleagues, we were able to successfully navigate and I think be on the cutting edge of providing emergency courtesy licenses for out-of-state psychologists whose patients had returned to Alaska. We were able to solidify kind of processes for supervision, telehealth supervision, and just kind of through that navigated the difficulties that came with being a psychologist. I like to say through our that we were pretty much the easiest board to deal with in terms of health treatment, because all we need is basically our mouths, a pen, and a pad of paper. So we were able to move pretty quickly on that process. Since my time on the board, we have expanded cross-cultural education, continuing education requirements, so individuals can be better prepared to serve Alaskans. And we've seen an influx of telehealth service provision from individuals in the lower 48 who may not necessarily be aware of the unique needs our population has in Alaska. And so kind of ensuring some continuity of care, some continuing education in that regard can be useful. I moved to Alaska in 2019 to serve as the chief forensic psychologist at API, and since that time have continued on in public service working for Copper River Native Association, and then my current employment at the Yakutat Community Health Center for the Thinkit tribe there.
Okay. Do we have any questions for Mr. McConnell from the committee? Sure. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair, Dr. McConnell. I guess I'll ask kind of the standard question. What kinds of issues do you see the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners facing in the next term, should you get confirmed?
There are two that I see, two significant ones. One is the attraction of psychologists to Alaska, but also the need for telehealth supervision. Right now, our statutes and regulations require individual face-to-face in the same building supervision, and about a week for postdoctoral trainees, an hour per week. And I see the vastness of Alaska being what it is. That is a barrier to attracting psychologists, both in Alaska and outside of Alaska. We have two doctoral level psychology programs, one at Alaska Pacific University and then one through UAA, UAF for PhD in clinical and community psychology. But a lot of times it's difficult for individuals to have supervision, to have psychologists employed in the same setting or willing to come on site for supervision, leading to a bottleneck, if you will. So I see that as an issue. And then the other major issue I see is there is a psychology compact called SciPact that has garnered a lot of attention in the lower 48, and about 40 different states have enacted it. But there are some logistical concerns that Alaskans have, namely in our statutes and regulations that allow for individuals from regionally accredited programs, but not programs accredited by the American Psychological Association, that can be very difficult, because that would mean that if we enacted SciPact as a board and got approval from the legislature to do this, that would effectively kill one of our two doctoral psychology programs in Alaska, meaning that nobody from that program, until they got accreditation by the APA, would be able to be a licensed psychologist, and they'd have to move elsewhere. So I see those as the two primary barriers at the moment.
Okay. If I may.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. And through the indulgence of the chair, Dr. McConnell, just curious, I know Alaska has, we have our challenges in Alaska, and I wonder if the general state of mental health in Alaska tends to be an attractant or a repellent for people to come to Alaska, to the state, and practice their profession of psychology. This is a kind of a subjective thought, but just like your thoughts on it.
Yes, I see it. I see that pay is truly an issue for attracting psychologists to serve, at least in the public sector. While it pays well comparatively to some other states in the lower 48, a lot of states in the lower 48 have taken note and are paying the same rates for their roles as psychologists. They've really kind of opened that up, and you can make more money in the private sector and public sector in the lower 48 as compared to Alaska. And so what you may find is individuals maybe working remotely from the lower 48 to Alaska, and never really step foot in Alaska. And so that can be difficult as well. I guess having come from the lower 48 to Alaska 5 years ago, it has been, a rewarding experience. Absolutely. But I could understand why people from the lower 48 might not want to physically be present in Alaska, which is a shame.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox, through the chair. Thank you for putting your name forward again for a reappointment. I'm curious about your experience at API as the chief forensic psychologist. And we've had a couple of bill hearings in this committee related to competency restoration. I know that one of the difficulties is that we don't have a lot of forensic psychologists in this state. And, you know, every state deals with a backlog and a big wait list of individuals waiting for competency restoration. So I'm wondering if you could just comment on the state of forensic psychologists and competency restoration in this state, challenges there, and ways to address it.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, I'm glad you asked. And actually, Dr. Bradbury, who's on, he and I shot an email back and forth about this actually this morning. And through the chair, when I ran the jail-based competency restoration program in California, we had about an 76 to 86% success rate of restoring individuals to competency without a backlog. It saved about 300 and I would say $65,000 per person, as opposed to being transported to California's Department of State hospitals. So a jail-based competency restoration program is highly effective. However, it has to have some solid programming and research base for it. What I found was that there was not a lot of programming when I was the chief forensic psychologist at API. And so a lot of individuals were deemed not competent and then released after charges were dropped. And so there were quite a few patients who would sort of circle back through. And right now, my understanding is Alaska's rates are about 36 to 44%. Competency restoration at best, comparative to about 80 to 85% in the lower 48. So I see jail-based competency restoration as a state saving, but I do believe that there are, as much as I would like to say, you know, it could be kept public, there are a lot of corporations down in the lower 48 who this is their bread and butter, this is all they do. And when it's privatized and they are in multiple states with multiple different statutes and laws, there is an extremely high success rate in competency restoration. And so I think that is something that eventually the legislature should look into because it is successful. And you know, it's unfortunate, right? Because it can be quality, quantity, and you have individuals who kind of languish in jail while waiting for 10 beds on the TACU unit at API. And this can be very disheartening because some of these individuals could be restored to could easily be restored to competency. There's just a lack of it.
Thank you. I really appreciate that feedback.
Okay, thank you. Mr. McConnell, did I understand you to say that that was done essentially in telehealth? Or is that just people coming up?
People through the chair, people coming up and, you know, sort of establishing a program inside the jail where it's more cost effective. I believe last I looked, I believe the daily rate for a patient at API is about $1,600 to $1,700 a day. And I don't know the numbers offhand for how much it costs to have somebody a daily rate for being incarcerated. But these individuals, these companies, this is kind of all they do. And so they are very, very good at doing it. And so it would save the state an exorbitant amount of money to have jail-based competency restoration, where individuals are receiving competency programming every day and being evaluated every day, you know, to see if somebody might be quote unquote ready to be assessed by a psychologist for competency to stand trial.
Interesting. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. McConnell? Okay. Thank you. And we will now take public testimony on the appointment of Bradley McConnell to the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners. And do we have anyone in the room that wishes to testify? Seeing none, do we have anyone online that wishes to testify? And I don't see anyone. If somebody does want to provide some testimony on Mr. McConnell's appointment, you can send it by email to hhss@akleg.gov. And thank you, Mr. McConnell. This was a valuable hearing. Good ideas. Thank you very much. So
thank
next.
You.
Oh, I have to mention also that Representative Sumner joined us at 3:10. All right, so our last confirmation hearing today is Lauren Bradbury to the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners. Mr. Bradbury, please put yourself on record and let us why you want to be on the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Lauren Bradbury. I live in Bethel, Alaska. I've been here for 31 years this summer. I have been on the board previously. I was on from, I think, for 7 years up till about, I don't remember what year it was, 2012 or 13, somewhere in there. I feel like I've lived most of my life in rural Alaska. I'm also a pastor. I pastored in Huna, in Juneau, and then went out to graduate school, have come back as a psychologist. And 11 years I worked for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, and then went into private practice in 2004, I believe it was, and have been doing a combination of clinical and forensic, but primarily forensic psychology today. That was what started coming my direction. So I find being on the board probably the most valuable lesson I've ever had in ethics. Those 7 years again, and I'm here and available to do that.
Sounds like the, what do they call that? It's breaking up. Poor network quality. It must be in.
What?
Would you mind giving us, would you be able to call us?
Yes, I can. I was on the line earlier, but this one came on. It popped up. I clicked on it initially. Let me go ahead and find the number here. And I'll call in. And I'll mute this end here and go on the other.
Alaska Legislative Teleconference System.
Turk, wasn't that? Are you with us?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Four, eight.
I'm with you. I'm just I muted it so it doesn't echo or anything. Yeah. I'm waiting to be picked up at your end.
Okay, thank you. Were we talking about broadband rural something or other?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I think you should be on the telephone. Are you with us?
I am. Well, let me get off of this. Okay, now I'm just on the telephone. The other was echoing, so okay.
All right. Please proceed.
Okay, and again, I don't know what you heard and what you didn't hear, but I'm Lauren Bradbury. I'm a psychologist. I've been a psychologist for nearly 31 years. I moved to Bethel 31 years ago. I've been in Alaska 51 years this summer. Came up in the Air Force and ended up getting out of the Air Force, pastoring in Hoonah and in Juneau. So I've spent most of my adult life in rural areas in Alaska. And so my work in the profession of psychology, I was for 11 years from 1993 to 2004, I was YKHC's clinical psychologist. And then in 2004, I went into private practice and have been practicing a mix of clinical and forensic psychology. And today it's primarily forensic that I do.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Bradbury? Representative Fields.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Mr. Bradbury, how many other psychologists serve in Bethel?
And again, in answering that through the chair, just myself. There's no other that I'm aware of. There's no other licensed psychologists out here.
Got it. Okay. Could I ask a follow-up?
Certainly.
Mr. Bradbury, Alaska does not have laws banning conversion therapy. Do you offer conversion therapy in the work that you do, or do you condone conversion therapy?
I certainly don't condone it, but I'm not really involved at this point. I'm primarily doing I'm doing forensic.
Okay. Are there situations where you have LGBTQ clients or people who need services, and how do you approach that given what you've said in some of your sermons?
Okay, so what I do is I actually explain what my core beliefs are, and if I'm not able to help someone in any area, I will refer them somewhere else.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Mr. Bradbury, you said your primary practice now is forensic psychology?
Yes.
Could you explain a bit what that involves in the Bethel area?
Well, forensic psychology itself is, you know, it's the idea of, it comes from the old idea of a debate to come to to finding of truth. And so what I do here, probably the majority of my work is in the area of competency to continue with legal proceedings. And I'm called upon now throughout the state. It's not just in Bethel, but different areas in the state. And I do things such as, you know, was this person competent to waive Miranda rights? Also, civil guardianship. And I do quite a few disability exams that are forwarded here.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any other questions for Mr. Bradbury? All right, in that event, I will open public testimony on the appointment of Lauren Bradbury to the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners. Do we have anyone in the room that wishes to testify on his appointment? And seeing none, do we have anyone online that would like to testify on the appointment of Mr. Bradbury to the Board of Psychologists and Sociological Associate Examiners? Seeing none, if anyone wants to send comments about his appointment, please email them to hhss@akleg.gov. And thank you, Mr. Bradbury, for your service, and we look forward to continued association.
Thank you very much.
All right. and we'll take a brief at ease and sign the paperwork. Back on record. And with that, the House Health and Social Services Committee has reviewed the qualification of governor's appointees John Lloyd to the Board of Chiropractic Examiners, Ashley Shaber to the Board of Pharmacy, and Bradley McConnell and Lauren Bradbury to the Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners, and sends their nomination to the full legislature for consideration. Signing this report does not reflect any individual's recommendation for approval or disapproval. We will take, and we just took a brief ease, and now we will move on to HB 191, thank you, Major Medical Emergencies, sponsored by Representative Mia. And here to assist her is her staff, Katie Giorgio. Giorgio. All right, very good. We have that. Please come to the table, put yourself on record, and introduce HB 191 to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Prox, and esteemed members of the House Health and Social Services Committee. For the record, my name is Genevieve Mina, and I am the House District 19 representative in the legislature. Here with me is my staff, Katie Giorgio, to present to you House Bill 191 relating to medical major emergencies. We'll provide a brief bill presentation verbally, and we have one invited testifier, Dr. Mike Levy, who will provide more additional context as someone who has been involved with the EMS systems. On the line, we also have available Gene Wiseman from the Office of Emergency Medical Services. House Bill 191 is a bill to modernize Alaska's EMS system, EMS, also known as Emergency Medical System, and to integrate major time-sensitive medical emergencies such as strokes and heart attacks. The goal is to help more Alaskans get the right care from the right person at the right time. I'll provide a little bit of background why we are bringing this bill forward and a bit of closing comments. For background on the history of EMS, about 50, 60 years ago in 1966, there was a white paper from the National Academy of Sciences called Accidental Death and Disability, the Neglected Disease of Modern Society. And it highlighted the poor care received by Americans who were suffering from major trauma. And in that paper, it said that an American received better care if they had received trauma care in a battlefield versus by a car crash on a highway. the attention on the need to improve our trauma system led to the creation of emergency medical services nationwide. And then we have now an office of EMS that's been around for a couple of decades. In the trauma system of care, there's a focus on this golden hour and making sure that you can address the trauma faced by a patient within a certain window of time. Now with Alaska's EMS system, we have an office of EMS to focus on Alaska's EMS system of care. It's placed within the Division of Public Health under the section of Rural and Community Health Systems. And that office has four highlighted duties in statute. One is to coordinate public and private agencies on our EMS system. The second is to assist agencies through grants. The third is to develop training and establish protocols, which includes certifying emergency medical technicians, EMS instructors, also looking at emergency medical dispatchers, ground and air ambulance services, and also establishing a process for hospitals and clinics to be trauma centers. Our EMS system focuses on trauma. However, EMS nationally as a movement has grown outside of trauma care. And we're bringing this bill forward because EMS has to include major medical emergencies, and the scope of our EMS office currently only focuses on trauma. So what do we mean by major medical emergencies? We're talking about time-sensitive emergencies, such as severe heart attacks, which are commonly called STEMIs, trauma, strokes, and sepsis. There are hospitals that are designated trauma centers, but there are also hospitals that are designated as stroke centers and are ideal places for STEMI care. There's been an evolution in our EMS system, and now STEMIs, strokes, and sepsis have their own best practices, not just trauma. When we're talking about best practices and the workflow for addressing these types of emergencies, these practices focus on pre-hospital notifications, patient data transmission, scoring the level of a stroke, sepsis, trauma, transportation, triaging labs and scans, and prompting data feedback back to our EMS system. And we also want to make sure that we can approve our EMS system as a state. There's been improvements in treatment, such as with severe strokes. LVOs are large vessel occlusions. They're about a quarter to a half of strokes that are ischemic. And the treatment has improved over the past decade, where instead of medication, there is a procedure called a mechanical thrombectomy, which has become the gold standard for stroke care. And if we're able to implement these best practices, it can mean the difference for a patient between receiving 24/7 care or walking out of the hospital the next day. And we want to make sure that the Office of EMS can reflect improvements in technology that's happening in our EMS system. We hope that with this bill, this will improve our EMS system to reduce transfer times for patients between hospitals. It will improve the quality of care to ensure that patients are being identified for the level of care that they need in an emergency situation, and also result in potential cost savings if we are able to ensure that there are better quality treatments that are delivered in a timely manner for someone who is in an emergency. In closing, we cannot change when a patient arrives at a hospital or calls 911, but what we can do is improve the workflow and the system of care during these medical emergencies. And we want to make sure that a patient getting the right treatment by the right person at the right time does not just pertain to trauma, but also these major medical emergencies that are time sensitive, such as severe heart attacks, strokes, and sepsis, which are the leading causes of death in this state.
Okay.
And I will pass it off to my staff, Katie Georgiou, to provide a brief sectional analysis, if I may.
We would be glad if you did.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Katie Giorgio, staff to Representative Genevieve Mina. Just briefly, Section 1 amends Title 18, Chapter 8, which covers the statewide EMS system. As Representative Mina explained, currently in statute, it only addresses trauma care. We will be adding the term other major emergencies to expand the authority of that office. Section 1, subsection 4, also addresses, gives DOH the statutory authority to develop criteria for health centers to represent themselves as being capable of receiving these major emergency patients. And Section 2 just defines what we mean by major medical emergency, which is in this bill, heart attack and stroke.
Okay, thank you. And I believe we have invited testimony, correct? Dr. Mike Levy, the Chief Medical Officer for Anchorage Area-Wide EMS. Mr. Levy, are you with us?
I am. Thank you, Chairman Prax, and members of the House Health and Social Services Committee. My name is Dr. Michael Levy, and I'm testifying on my own behalf in support of House Bill 191, an act for medical care for major emergencies. By way of introduction, I'm the immediate past president for the National Association of EMS Physicians. I'm the State of Alaska EMS Medical Director. I'm the Chief Medical Officer at Anchorage Area-Wide EMS and the EMS Medical Director for agencies, including Anchorage Fire Department, Chugiak Volunteers, Kenai Peninsula Borough EMS, and I sponsor other agencies as well. I'm a physician. I've practiced in Alaska since 1989, and I'm board certified in emergency medicine, enteral medicine, and subspecialty board certified in the specialty of EMS medicine. So I'm in support of House Bill 191. This bill seeks to facilitate formation of a coordinated system of care to enhance the chance of survival and functional recovery in life-threatening, time-critical emergencies in adults and children in Alaska. It seeks to assure that Alaskans and our visitors suffering from these medical crises receive care by the right person, at the right place, at the right time. As stated, trauma, stroke, sepsis, and heart attacks are major causes of death and disability in our state. At present, we don't have coordinated systems of care for heart attack centers, sepsis centers, nor stroke centers, but we've achieved great results as a result of 2010 trauma legislation. An important point is that places can become certified in a certain type of care, for example, stroke care. But as would happen with the trauma systems, state designation of those hospitals that are in accord with the national body is very important. So with the stroke system, the American College of Surgeons was used as the reference point for trauma designation. We don't have that currently in the state for designation for heart attack centers or stroke centers, for example. This bill would essentially expand the success of that 2010 legislation and lay the foundation for a similar care for stroke and heart attacks. And it would allow the Department of Health to replicate those systems and processes that have improved trauma care and apply those principles to stroke, possibly sepsis and heart attack, as well as define that those major emergencies that shall include heart attacks and stroke. So much as was accomplished with the trauma center program, this House Bill 199 should ensure that the receiving specialty hospitals remain in compliance with the systems and their processes, meet a DOH adopted national criteria for being, for example, a stroke or heart attack center. And finally, helping to establish a registry to specific for these emergencies to allow us to measure and improve our performance in Alaska. Mr. Chairman, members of the Health and Social Service Committee, this completes my testimony, but I'll remain on the line for the committee should there be any questions. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Hey, Representative Fields. Thank you, through the chair. I was just reading this article in the New York Times over the weekend about how a lot of states are being slow at rolling out ECPR, basically a more effective intervention for heart attacks. And I was just curious if you would observe that here in Alaska. It sure seems like this bill could help. And I didn't know if you were following that specific type of treatment. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. I definitely am. In fact, the person that's highlighted in that thing, Demetrius, is a friend of mine. And I'm well aware of that program. I would point out that in the state of Alaska at this point in time, the entire state of Alaska lacks any type of ECPR program for acute emergencies. I'm not sure if this would be within the scope of House Bill 191, but it would certainly be aspirational in terms of elevating the level of care for these critical emergencies.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Representative Fields.
If I could just ask a follow-up to the bill sponsor, it seems to me like the way the bill is written, it would enable seeking grants and aid for better treatment for heart attacks. Would the bill sponsor agree with that interpretation? Thank you.
Thank you for the question, Representative Fields. For the record, Genevieve Mina, House District 19 Representative. I would defer to Gene Wiseman, who I believe is on the line, who works in the Office of EMS, if they could speak to grants that the department usually oversees and the scope of those grants as it pertains to trauma. And I think we might be able to understand how that could relate to heart attacks.
Okay. Mr. Wiseman, are you with us?
Yes, Chair Prox, this is Gene Wiseman. I'm the section chief for Rural Community Health System, which houses EMS and our Trauma Systems Unit. As to, you know, grants, our office does, the Office of EMS does facilitate grant delivery when they're available. And, you know, for the different projects, I'm not familiar with, you know, any grants specifically available at this time that are focused for stroke and STEMI. But that is something that we would, could, and will do, you know, when we have identified those funding streams.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before I ask my questions, I want to say that certainly heart attacks and strokes are bad. I don't wish them anybody. So please don't interpret my questions as trying to downgrade them, but I'm not quite sure I see that I understand the reason or the need for this. Are emergency rooms not now capable of treating what are called major emergencies, which are defined as heart attacks and strokes? I'm not sure, probably the doctor who just spoke, probably the best person to testify, but just whoever wants to answer.
Thank you for the question, Rep. Sadler. For the record, Genevieve Mina, House District 19 Representative. I'll take a stab at answering this question, pun intended, and I'll also defer to Dr. Levy on his perspective as well. But stepping back for a second, the goal of this bill is to improve our statewide system of care, and so I acknowledge that individual hospitals and clinics have their best practices for addressing heart attacks and strokes, but this bill also focuses on how those hospitals and clinics coordinate with each other, especially as it relates to sharing data and screenings and making sure that providers are receiving the right information to apply the appropriate diagnosis and to identify which procedure is appropriate. And there's a lot of downtime in an emergency situation that can be related to waiting on screenings and from data from different hospitals and the communication that these facilities have between each other. But I would love to hear from Dr. Levy his feedback as well.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Sadler. So, for example, on strokes, there's three different levels of certification for stroke centers. Basic ones. There's a primary stroke center, a thrombectomy capable stroke center, and then a comprehensive stroke center. So, for example, in Anchorage, each of those iterations exists with different hospitals. There's at least two different certifying bodies that could endow those institutions with that certification. There's no designation from the state that confirms those certifications, nor does it coordinate how patients are distributed to those places. And that's just in Anchorage. And if you kind of get that out to our broad, vast state, you know, how do we best take care of time-sensitive critical emergency like a stroke when it's in Bethel or someplace that doesn't have a CAT scan? Are they best brought directly to Anchorage by air, which may take them out of a crucial window of intervention? Do we take them to a place where there may be a CAT scan but does not have the skills and capabilities that we do in Anchorage? So even though there's extremely talented, great hospital work that goes on in our community and in others, each of those are to some extent a silo to themselves with no overarching organization, education, training, and data center to basically improve our system and to coordinate care. A little wordy, but I hope that helps answer the question, sir.
Follow up from Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I'll try to speak in plain language too. So does each hospital have a list of designations of conditions that they are qualified or designated to treat? Again, I'm not familiar with the healthcare system, so I'm speaking as a layman here. I'm not quite sure what a designation as a center for stroke or a designation for broken arms or legs or a designation for kidney failure. Does each hospital have a list of such designations that it's necessary to add heart attack and stroke designations to each hospital?
Well, again, these are terms through the chair, if I may. This is Dr. Levy. The designation should be something that comes from the state, as it does for trauma centers. So it's easier maybe to refer back to the trauma centers. When we first started formulating a trauma system in this state, one option that was put out was that hospitals themselves would define how trauma care should be done and perhaps provide some kind of documents that say that the hospital itself would adhere to these sorts of principles. The other possibility, and the one we adopted, was to use national standards in the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma, which is very regulated, very specific, and requires a high degree of commitment from the hospitals to comply with that certification. The hospital then goes under review by the trauma system based on the ACS-COT guidelines. And if they meet those strict criteria, then they are designated at a trauma 1, trauma 2, trauma 3, trauma 4 level of designation. That then allows us to better take patients to facilities that have gotten, you know, the seal of approval based on national standards. So in Anchorage, we have 2 level 2s, we have no level 1, and we have a level 3. So when trauma occurs in the Anchorage Bowl and trauma that comes in from outside, we have criteria in our system of care for what type of patients would best be served at a level 2 and which patients could be treated elsewhere. So actually, I misspoke there just a little bit. We don't have a level 3 in Anchorage, but we have level 3s elsewhere in the state and in the general environment. So the same sort of thing would then also obtain for things like stroke. So even though a person had a stroke certification at a given level, the state would define whether or not that certification was one that was deemed the proper one for us to use based on national standards. And then also require that the institution provided to the state that they met the requirements day in, day out based on their quality program at that level of designation. That would allow us to stratify patients to the best place appropriate for their particular problem. Again, wordy, but I hope that helps.
Can I follow up?
Representative Sadler.
Through the chair, Dr. Levy, correct me if I'm wrong. So it sounds like there is a national designation. I think the analog we're using is the trauma center designation. So there's a national designation, standards which must be met, and we're proposing to have there is also a state designation for trauma. Am I seeing evidence of parallel structures, which I don't know if they are necessary? We're a small state, you know, we're a small town in a big state, not too many hospitals, not too many EDs, but don't most healthcare professionals kind of know the capabilities and the national designations of hospitals to which they may be sending patients? Well, how is a state designation provide additional value to the healthcare system?
Thank you, and through the chair. The additional value is to better, identify that people are meeting those criteria. Right now, those are internal criteria, which we have no insight into, as opposed to the trauma system, where it's an open book for us to see that they actually meet those criteria. This is otherwise housed internally. The important points there are, for example, in Anchorage. Anchorage EMS has no guidance right now in terms of where to take patients for stroke, even though there's 3 different levels of stroke certification which exist within the community at the different hospitals. State designation would then make it very clear that a person that might have that condition, which was called a large vessel occlusion, would best be served at perhaps the highest level of care if the state so designated. So that there's no really internal sort of communication where doctors or mid-levels understand de novo or somehow intrinsically that this hospital or that hospital would be the right place to go. There's also no criteria or no requirements right now that they meet the ability to care for these patients at this percentage of time or the like with regard to the way state is oversight occurs. So again, this is a systems of care issue. What you've described is a fragmented system where people go kind of where they want based on sort of their own anecdote. And what we're trying to promote is that people go to facilities that have a high likelihood of providing the care that we hope will be provided at that level for that need.
Well, if I may follow, I don't want to monopolize conversation, but if I may. So I thought I understood you to say that there are national designations for levels of care at hospitals. Is that correct?
There are national designations of care for trauma centers, for example.
Okay.
There are national levels of care for heart attack centers based on the American Heart Association, the American College of Cardiology, in terms of their capabilities, et cetera.
And follow up, so and are those national designations insufficient to provide information inside Alaska as to the capabilities of the hospitals and EDs to treat patients? I'm not trying to be argumentative. I'm just trying to see if what the state designation, what value it brings that the national designation does not bring.
Through the chair. So designation, there's a little bit of semantics.
Well,
the national institutions, such as the American Heart Association, do not designate per se. The state designates that based on the criteria set by the state, a facility meets the criteria to be a heart attack center. For example, an acute a PCI center, a center that can do a catheterization for acute heart attacks. So that is a state function based upon, you know, standards from a national body. That's just example, the American Heart Association.
So
the idea of having the United States a national level that says, this is the criteria. Setting the criteria is not the same as having designation based on oversight, based on criteria that are set for that state.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Prox. I actually have just a couple of questions. I think probably best for Dr. Levy and then maybe one for the bill sponsor. So the first question probably for the doctor is, do we have, I guess, or I think the levels are one being the highest for stroke, but do we have a level one stroke center in Alaska?
We do. They're, again, not to be pedantic, they're called, they're letter designations. So a thing called a comprehensive stroke center is the highest level of stroke center that's recognized, which I'm aware. And yes, we have one.
We have one. Okay. And then follow up, if I may, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of questions, I guess. So with that, there's a time component to that, I think I recall. And if there is, for example, let's say that comprehensive stroke center is in Anchorage. I don't know if it is or isn't. And you have to be within a certain subset of hours to be transferred to that facility. And if you're outside of that, then you go to a different level. Can you walk me through that process?
Thank you. And through the chair. Yes, very good. So the stroke is a time critical event, and there's different time levels. Strokes are discussed with regard to their time of onset, when last known well. And in the first 4.5 hours, there's an opportunity to use a clot-busting drug for some strokes and some people. And that's typically the first step at most centers, even the comprehensive stroke centers. Drugs could be given, for example, in Bethel for a person that presented with an acute stroke within the time frame based on a CAT scan that showed the absence of any signs of a intracranial bleeding within the head. When you get beyond the 4.5 hours, then the only therapies that are available are catheter-based therapies, which are provided at either a comprehensive stroke center or a thrombectomy-capable stroke center. Those can typically be given out to 24 hours. But, and in addition to that, the interventions that are provided acutely, be it a clot-busting intervention or be it a catheter-based intervention, a thing where you actually pull the clot out, those are extremely important functions. But, for example, a comprehensive stroke center should bring much more to the table than that. Neurosurgical capabilities, in case something is needed to be done besides clot extraction, something to do with bleeding in the head or the like. Higher levels of stroke care, rehab services, basically a complete step up from the next tier, and the tier there is a step up from the lower tier. So even those people that are not within the window can often benefit from being at a higher level of stroke care.
Thank you for that answer. One additional question, if I may, Mr. Chair. So I think the trauma designations that were passed, and I think that was in the early 2000s at some point, it seems like, but there was a, and I'm just reading and I have the book in front of me, so sorry if this is all a little new, but there was a care fund that was associated with helping to promote increase care designations for trauma in the state of Alaska. So we have one comprehensive stroke center in the state, largest state in the union. Is the intention behind some of this to increase the number of highly specialized or highly higher capacity care organizations around the state? So let's say for comprehensive stroke, maybe the goal is to have three of those. Or is it just to know you only have one and this is where it's at? And if so, is there maybe an intention to have some sort of funding element? And I think somebody asked a question about grants, and I think that was to Mr. Wiseman, but to help promote higher level care centers throughout the state. Because I think there would have to be a dollar amount associated with that as well. So maybe just speak generally to that. I don't know who, I think that's to you, and you can direct that to whoever you want to. But
if I may, this is Dr. Levy again, and through the chair. It would be nice to think that we could have comprehensive stroke centers stationed throughout our state, but I think that's really not realistic. The comprehensive stroke center requires very sophisticated, honestly very expensive equipment and personnel. So it requires a sophisticated cath lab, staffed by cath lab people, et cetera. But it also requires neurointerventionalists, which across the country are in short supply. And so the possibility of having this specialized of a practitioner, you know, out in a less populated area, I think is unlikely, and it probably isn't the best use of resources. So I personally think it's unlikely that we would have, nor that it would make economic sense or other kinds of sense to have multiple CSCs through the state, but instead to have better policy and procedure, education, training for how we best process people, and honestly, seeing when it's really most appropriate to keep people in their communities at primary stroke centers. It's not everybody should be transferred to the highest level because those capabilities may not be necessary. They may be, frankly, futile. So I think that's another important thing that this kind of legislation could help us work through. Thank you.
I guess just a follow-up to that, to Dr. Levy. Thank you for that. I think that was exactly sort of my question. And so that led sort of to another question, which is in order to prioritize who gets transferred and who does not in a bill such as this, is there an element for some of these care centers to utilize their resources that they have in a central location, let's say at the comprehensive stroke center, and use some sort of telehealth component to assess someone's need for transfer within some sort of window. Is that happening now, or is that a thing that can happen in the future?
Through the chair, if I may answer, I believe that's the answer to that is yes. I think that the goal would be to, when possible, leave people in their communities because of the solace and the support, et cetera, that someone might have in their community, as opposed to being sent, you know, away from family and the like to a big city for other stuff. So the telehealth is a big component of this. There's another project going on now, which is a type of computer program that's being, there's a grant actually that they're working on that's called Rapid AI, and it interprets CAT scans done at with regular CAT scan without enhanced technology that can give them a pretty good idea whether people would benefit from having any type of higher level intervention, such as at the CSC or the TSC we were talking about. So the answer to your question is yes, I think there's a lot of opportunity for leveraging technology now and going forward to help triage people as to where they might best be served. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Dr. Levy, how many Alaska hospitals are likely to, should this bill become law, how many would likely to receive state designation as major emergencies designated hospitals? There's only so many hospitals in Alaska. How many of them would get this designation if it were available?
Thank you. And through the chair, I can't answer that specifically, but let me give you an analogy. When we look at the trauma systems, we started off looking at trauma care and building the highest levels of care, which are the level twos in the state. But since then, there's been a lot of effort placed in improving the trauma care at clinics and outlying areas and designating those as, for example, level fours, setting standards that the facilities had to meet that are reviewed on a periodic basis based on the designation and the rules that are followed within the state. So it's not just a stamp that somebody can use for marketing. They have to actually meet the criteria that are appropriate for that facility, but at the level four. And there's no giveaways because you almost made it, for example, at life. So the idea is there's a standard. It's a lower standard than a level three or a level two or a level one. So you can see similar opportunities with regard to heart attack. So there's a number of different levels of heart attack care that are described in the American Heart Association documents on this. Similarly, we could improve stroke care through education, training, and help people identify, one, when a stroke occurs, help the EMS system better understand how to treat strokes, integrate this into community care for some folks, integrate this into when it's important to use the other resources we have, such as ground or air transport, to move to higher levels of care. Thank you.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Representative Sadler.
So well and good, but still trying to get some estimate of how many hospitals in Alaska would get that designation. You made the point that having a target to aim at might tend to raise rising tide might raise all boats, but any idea how many hospitals might earn or justify or be qualified to get designated as a major emergency hospital?
With regard to stroke or heart attack or both?
Which is what we're defining a major medical emergency as, yes, sir.
So I think it would not necessarily be a one person, one designation, major emergency designation. I think it would be each would be a separate designation, be it stroke care, be it heart attack care, be it trauma care. So each of those would be independent because they require different resources. So a hospital, might be stroke care, but it's not heart attack care for whatever reason, because it couldn't meet those criteria. With regard to stroke care, one of the major stratifications for stroke care would be whether or not a hospital has a CAT scan. So the computerized tomography is fundamental to the care of strokes because we can't give drugs for stroke unless we can be sure that there's no bleeding going on in the head. So in terms of the numbers, you could, the first stratification with regard to stroke care would be which hospitals have CAT scans and which don't. If you don't have a CAT scan, then you can't be at the level of care of other places with CAT scans. So that those hospitals that don't have CAT scan would fundamentally be at a lower level than those that do have CAT scan. And then with regard to heart attack care, I don't know how to exactly put that out because I don't know. There's the ability to provide percutaneous interventions in Fairbanks, in Matsu, in the CPH, in and those are the only that I'm aware of people that have the ability to do interventions. We can stratify that again in terms of how many hours that the cardiologist is available, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a little complicated, so I can't give you a number off the top of my head, but I can broadly say there's levels of stratification based on resources. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Levy, I'm just trying to get some sense of right now the legislation on page 2, line 2, talks about the establishment under which hospitals and clinics could represent themselves to be trauma centers or otherwise capable of treating major emergencies being defined in this bill as heart attack or stroke. Simply, if you can, how many hospitals, you said there's three levels, designation as stroke, designated as heart attack, designated as trauma. Roughly, simply, how many facilities in Alaska will be designated for stroke centers, for heart attack centers, and trauma centers? If you can be as precise as you can be, Leslie.
Through the chair, I'd love to be precise, but I don't have the denominator. This is not a calculation I've done, so I really can't truthfully answer that question with any accuracy. Perhaps Representative Mina can, but I don't have the information for you.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. For the record, Representative Genevieve Mina, and I also don't have those designations at hand. We could also ask Gene Wiseman with the Division of Rural Health to see if he could speak to that.
The reason I ask, Mr. Chairman, is we've heard the analogy of stroke centers and trauma centers and the benefits to be derived from that. It would not seem to be too much of an ask to know how many such trauma centers we do have.
Wiseman?
Yep. Through the chair, this is Gene Wiseman, Section Chief, Rural Community Health System. So our trauma system, which is voluntary in nature, we currently have 14 trauma centers across the state, two of which are the level twos in Anchorage. And then we have level fours that are, kind of surrounded in our larger or in our hub communities. So from that, extrapolating from that, and there are two others that are looking to become centers to meet that standard. One, which is in Wrangell, Husqvarna Health Corporation, is also looking to become redesignated as a trauma center. So when those, when those happen, that would put the number to 16 across the state that meet the standards for the trauma system. And if I could add in there, we're talking about the systems of care and the designation of, the different centers, whether it's a trauma center or a cardiac center or a stroke center. It helps, basically from the onset of symptoms, and let's say, and I'm a my background is as a flight paramedic for years as well, and I've been on the recipient end of these types of calls. If I fly into a village and I have, let's say, an identified heart attack that's identified on the EKG, and they meet the signs and symptoms, then, that would raise to me as the medevac, carrier, where do I bring this patient? Are they better served, at the local hub community hospital or bypassing, and all of the systems of care and organization that would go into making that determination? So it's helpful to build the system of care by focusing on these other two major emergencies. To answer your question, Dr. Sadler, Representative Sadler, I could only guess at the number, but I would imagine that depending on the level of care, it would be similar to our trauma centers. and it would take time to develop them.
And these follow up, and these would be self-designation or state designation of stroke centers and heart attack centers.
These are state designations through, and like I said, the participation by facilities is voluntary. And so they would apply to meet that standard and voluntarily meet that standard to whichever center they're applying for.
Okay. I think this would be for Mr. Wiseman. Do you have some sort of a plan or a roadmap on how this system would be built out?
Through the chair, Gene Wiseman again, we have the roadmap from the trauma system, and the process would be parallel. So the trauma system review committee is developed under the Department of Health, Division of Public Health, and it brings together the subject matter experts, and that would be reviewing applications and working with, you know, whichever the accrediting body is. In the case of trauma, it's the American College of Surgeons. To develop those guidelines to meet the standard. The Trauma Review Committee then reviews the application, and they look at, you know, the systems and processes in the facilities that are applying to see if they meet that standard. And some of those standards are linking, you know, community-based EMS, you know, to the hospital and ensuring that there's training and that transition of care happens in an expedient fashion. But the process is replicatable from what we did with the trauma systems.
Okay. And this is, I'm understanding this to be focused on the hospitals, the buildings in fixed locations. Is that the correct understanding?
Through the chair, Gene Wiseman. Yes, that is correct for the designation. That hospitals are the point of definitive care. So those would be the organizations and the facilities that would be accredited or certified as whichever system that they're applying for.
Okay. Then has there been thought given to efficient utilization of resources? There we go. Where I'm thinking... I don't know, 30, 40 years ago, I was involved with the local fire department, which got in the EMS business. And when we were discussing that at the time, it was just show up at the scene, get the people to the hospital as quick as you could. And then over a couple of years, somebody came up with the idea that it made sense to focus more attention, training, and resources to on-site. So we might end up spending a lot of time. In fact, people were wondering why we were hanging around at the site rather than going to the hospital. But it was for a very good reason. We thought we'd get better results. So is somebody thinking about efficient utilization of resource and comparing the cost and benefits of spending money at designated spots, hospitals, versus more attention to getting better service at the point of contact, if you will. And I'm thinking just in the Fairbanks North Pole area, which is one, but on a broader scale, if you have to get somebody from Wiseman or Northway or wherever to Fairbanks, that's quite a different calculation. So are we thinking about that, about this trauma center designation and the money that would be spent on it in terms of the overall problem of emergency medical services throughout Alaska?
Through the chair, Gene Wiseman, yes, in fact, along with these designations, there's a focus that goes on to training, to recognition, to tying the systems of care to get the patient from the, you know, from the time of onset from their home to the right care at the right time so they can meet the windows for these interventions. So that takes system development. As it pertains to EMS, the protocols that will be developed secondary because of these designations and help to triage where these patients are going will focus on, you know, rapid recognition and decrease scene times because they're focusing their training efforts more laser-like on to these very specific issues to help move the patient to the right location. If the patient's moved to the wrong location, to a hospital that's not capable or is uncomfortable and has not practiced their policies, their procedures in this developed accredited system, then we're losing more time potentially, right, for that patient where minutes kind of matter.
Okay. Mr. Wiseman, I guess, are you kind of in charge of the whole everything from local EMS departments to Providence Hospital, I suppose? Are you in charge of some system, or is there coordination with local emergency response departments? There's another group that is focused on that, and how are you coordinating with them?
So through the chair, in my section, I have five units in my section. The two that are focused on this area is my trauma systems unit, which is where it should this bill become all. This is where they live in the trauma system, where they coordinate. They're the ones that coordinate through the committee and the accreditation process. They work with the facilities. I also have the Office of EMS, which, you know, we support emergency medical services, you know, through curriculum, as well as, you know, licensure and system design and development. So we're focused, you know, at that broader system approach, which when you think about emergency medical services, that ties in. It's not only the ambulance on the street or the air ambulance, but that's through to definitive care into that interaction with the emergency room or, you know, the facility in which they're transporting to. So, you know, where this would come into play, let's take a stroke or a heart attack that meets the threshold for a cath lab, you know, by training focused on the delivery of the delivery and care of those patients, it will expedite, you know, from recognition through to transport to the receiving facility. Typically, you know, on the ambulance, they'll call ahead. In this case, in the case of trauma, it'd be a trauma alert where they bring the right people to the emergency room to receive that patient. They would do similar, you know, with a heart attack patient, and may even in some cases bypass directly to the cath lab, which it happens from time to time, depending on the interaction of EMS and medical control at that receiving facility. So that coordination piece is key. And my units that I oversee, they're responsible to help facilitate and build that system by working with local providers and local systems, local EMS agencies to help facilitate building this program out.
I guess, frankly, I would like to see a little bit more detail on what you have in mind, because in Fairbanks, the decision is easy. There's only one place to go. In Anchorage, you might have, I don't know, two or three, but in Fairbanks, it's easy. And so I'm not quite understanding the benefit of this whole program, given the stage of development of Alaska's emergency care system as it sits today. And it seems to me like we would have to be spending tens of millions, if not more, to set up something like this. And we would need some sort of plan to decide whether it makes more sense to increase the level of care in Anchorage or Fairbanks, or increase the level of response out in the rural areas, and some way to figure out where we're going. Have you done any work along those lines, or could you give us some information along the lines of an overall plan and a cost estimate?
Sure. Through the chair, the current cost estimate is actually for one additional staff member within the trauma systems to help measure, monitor, and facilitate the conversations with the partners and collaborate with a new committee design to help build this system. Of course, you know, in Fairbanks, you know, where there's one hospital and you're tied to the road system, you know, the choice is clear, but where does that patient go if Fairbanks is not capable? So, the system would, as it's developed, would triage that patient to the most appropriate. Now, let's take a patient that is in Nuiqsut that is presenting with, you know, these signs and symptoms, and Samuel Simmons Hospital, which is the hub hospital, is that the most appropriate facility? Or is, because it would be an air ambulance movement. So the system, as it's designed, would and as it develops, would say, okay, maybe Samuel Simmons is not the most appropriate hospital, but Fairbanks is. But that's not typical right now for a transport from, you know, the medevac provider that works up in that region. So they would then build bypass protocols to get the patient to the right time, or to the right location. So it's not, there's not a cost associated with that. It's the ability to collaborate and build the system and design the procedures and policies and flow and algorithms that help those decision trees. Oftentimes in our rural hospitals and our hub communities, you know, the physicians that are serving in the emergency room may be locum tenens and not familiar with Alaska policy and procedure, the Alaska, not policy procedure, but the Alaska healthcare system. So that provider who may have ordered the medevac out of a village without, you know, a system design, you know, may not know where those facilities are, or be able to make expedient choices to, okay, let's move this patient to Providence in Anchorage versus bringing them here into Upiave.
Through the chair, I'd also like to take a stab at this, if I may. This is Dr. Levy.
Dr. Levy, please go ahead.
Thank you. So, for example, in the Fairbanks example, I want to be very clear that I'm not misinterpreted. Fairbanks is doing a great job from what I've seen from a committee we have with regard to the care of heart attacks requiring a catheter intervention. So don't misinterpret, please, what I'm going to say next. But as an example, without, they do that to an internal standard, for example. They provide that care to an internal standard, as opposed to an external standard saying, how long did it take you from the patient arrived at the door to when they went in and had an intervention done? There's national standards for that. But we right now don't have any criteria or way to assess that to give the community assurance that these, that facility, and again, I'm using a specific facility, which is wrong, which I want to reemphasize that this is an example only, and they do a great job. But that facility meets the standard that would be expected anywhere, not just in that particular locale. Now, the hope is that if you provide that standard for a facility that's isolated, such as up in Fairbanks, then they would strive to meet that, and then the state would simply certify that, designate it as such that they've met that. And that should serve as a good thing for the community to know. Alternatively, for example, I have operations up on the North Slope. And the closest place from Alpine Clinic, for example, for a person having a cardiac problem is Fairbanks by air, as opposed to coming to Anchorage. Sometimes it's going to be appropriate to take a person to Fairbanks as opposed to taking them to Anchorage. But higher levels of PCI care could involve ventricular assist devices and other higher levels of an intervention that may not be available even at places that have a cath lab. So then you have another stratification in the same sense that we have for who can take level 2 trauma, who can take level 3 trauma. So again, I think there's some important points there for oversight and defining the system from, you know, the standpoint of what the state says should be based on national standards, allows local communities to reach that, but also allow us to know when we want to bypass a facility and go a little bit further, perhaps by air, to a facility that has the full boat capabilities that this patient may require. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. A question to Dr. Levy through the chair. Just as a semantic question, looking on page 1 of the bill, lines 7, 8, and 9, says the department shall coordinate public and private agencies involved in the planning and delivery of emergency medical services, comma, including trauma care, purports to add, and care of major emergencies, comma. My question is, does the term emergency medical services include trauma and major emergencies?
Through the chair and to Mr. Sadler, I would like, if I could, to refer that back to Representative Mina, just so I don't misinterpret the intention of the bill.
Actually, sir, I would appreciate if you'd give a shot. If you're the Director of State Emergency Medical Services, that's a fair question to you, I believe.
Yes. So your question is, does emergency medical services care encompass both trauma and medical care, if I understood you?
Does the term emergency medical services include trauma care and care for major emergencies?
Yes, it does.
It does, yes? Very good. Thank you.
Yes.
And if I could ask a follow-up question? For sure. Thank you. And I guess, my question, how many designations does the state offer other than trauma care designation for healthcare facilities?
Through the chair, and again, deferring to Mr. Wiseman, who's more in charge of that than I am, the only one I'm aware of is trauma designation.
And Mr. Wiseman, if you want to take a crack at that, just for confirmation.
Through the chair, Gene Wiseman, that's accurate. From our office, we only designate trauma centers, and that is because of the inclusion of trauma into that statute that gave our department the authority to build specifically trauma designations.
Okay, I guess I would, if I may follow, is there anything to prohibit trauma care from or emergency medical, I'm sorry, does anything prohibit trauma care and major emergency care from being included in the medical services system that the state's now authorized to plan for, direct, support, encourage, and grant for?
Through the chair, I will have to get back to you on that. I don't have the statute pulled in front of me. The when it talks to the trauma designation, there is a subtitle in the within that statute that is focused on the trauma care delivery portion of why that's carved out as EMS, trauma in the original statute. So there's associated authority within that statute that allow for the designations to occur. But legally speaking, I would have to get back to you as far as building out a designation without that statutory authority.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? Representative Mina, we will give you the last word.
Thank you, Chair Prox. I have 5 points and then just a closing comment. So first, just related to Rep. Ruffridge's question related to creating a fund similar to a trauma fund, that is a good idea, but it's not within the scope of this current bill. We were intentional about keeping this language broad and just focusing on the authority within the Office of EMS. Second, in terms of data and progress that's being done there, Dr. Levy spoke about the rapid workflow related to severe strokes. There are also providers who are engaged in working groups. I believe there is a new nonprofit that was founded called the Alaska Stroke Coalition to help study on ways to improve data. But what we want to do is help reduce the burden that these providers are undergoing to improve their workflows, because I personally would want these providers to provide this life-saving care. And that's where we see the role of the state in this system. Number three, in terms of the designation of the trauma centers, I am very appreciative of the discussion and the nuance related to how trauma designation works in this state. But I want to step back and acknowledge that there are four duties that are listed in statute for the department related to EMS, and designation of trauma centers is one of those four duties. This bill is really about expanding the scope of our EMS system in this state so that the ongoing work that the department and the division does in terms of coordinating agencies, creating best practices, and educating providers is done on a systems level that is beyond just trauma care. Number four, in terms of the amount of money that this may require, I want to draw attention to the fiscal note that highlights one FTE in addition to the existing unit of $148,500. So we don't anticipate millions of dollars, and we don't have a fund included in this bill. And finally, in terms of hospitals that are undergoing their best practices for stroke care, our hospitals are doing a great job with their internal best practices. And if our hospitals are doing good care for strokes and severe heart attacks, we want them to coordinate with each other. And we want to make sure that this knowledge and this education is also coordinated to help improve the system of care, especially in rural areas where they don't have that support. And so finally, I acknowledge that with our EMS system, there is a bit of state involvement in there, but it's there for a reason. And this EMS system was created because there was a need for public health to acknowledge and address needs related to emergencies. We all voted unanimously to abolish the Alaska Council on EMS Services because there's also an acknowledgement from within the department that EMS has shifted beyond the original statute that defined EMS. And so we want to ensure that the department can continue to progress so that it is not just restricted to trauma, but they can also have the authority to work on heart attacks and on strokes. Thank you for the hearing and for the discussion. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for presenting the bill. I think we will have to set this aside and do a little more thinking about it, if there's no objection to that from the committee. And, pardon? so yes, we will set this aside, and if we have no other questions or business that I can think of for today, the Health and Social Services Committee adjourns at 4:58.